Okay, so I have no relationships to disclose. So this project was a collaboration between the Substance Use Disorder Quality Enhancement Research Initiative, which I'm a part of, and the Clinical Public Health Group's Tobacco and Health Policy and Programs, and was funded by the latter office. So just to give you a bit of a background, historically, smoking prevalence among veterans receiving VHA care has been higher than that of the general U.S. population. But about over the last decade, the VHA has taken significant steps to reduce tobacco use among veterans receiving VHA care. And around the same period, the prevalence of smoking among veteran enrollees has actually declined by a third and is now closer to that of the U.S. population. However, despite these improvements, patients or individuals with substance use disorders and mental health conditions still are at very high risk for tobacco dependence. And while the high prevalence of smoking among substance-using populations is well documented and the disproportionate risk factors associated is well documented, tobacco dependence treatment has historically not been a significant part of addiction settings. In fact, mental health and addiction settings have historically reinforced tobacco use among patients. However, there is fortunately growing recognition that tobacco dependence treatment has a place in addiction settings and can be efficacious. Hence, the VHA has sort of invested a thrust of efforts into improving tobacco dependence treatment for VA patients and really addressing these gaps in care. So as part of these efforts, we set out to first identify whether there is a need. And our first objective was to characterize the current status of integrated tobacco treatment implementation in substance use disorder residential treatment programs, and I'll call these SRTPs. Secondly, we set out to identify barriers and facilitators to integrating tobacco treatment in these settings. And when I'm talking about integrated tobacco treatment, I'm referring to components such as screening, brief intervention, referrals with structured follow-up, and evidence-based pharmacotherapy and counseling. So we chose said residential programs. First of all, the VHA operates 63 said residential programs nationally. And these are intensive settings that are also expensive, and the VHA invests heavily in them. So we thought that these would be potentially unique opportunities to deliver evidence-based tobacco treatment to a very high-risk population. We used a traditional linear mixed method study design. For our quantitative component, we used existing VHA administrative and pharmacy data sets to estimate the prevalence of tobacco users, to estimate the rates of tobacco dependence diagnosis and treatments in SRTPs, and also to identify predictors of NRT receipt among this population. And the population we studied consisted of 15,000 veterans who received SRTP care in fiscal year 10. The VA operates in fiscal years, which starts October 1st. And for our qualitative component, we conducted intensive semi-structured interviews with 25 staff members from 14 randomly selected SRTPs. And we explored staff knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, as well as perceived barriers and facilitators to integrated tobacco treatment. So I'll go over the quantitative results first. So because smoking status is unfortunately not available or was not available in VHA data sets at the time that we did this project, we had to estimate the likely prevalence. And we looked at all SRTP patients with any recorded diagnosis or treatment in fiscal year 10 or fiscal year 9. And our results were 79% of SRTP patients were estimated to be tobacco users. And fortunately, this was in line with estimates in similar settings, so residential addiction programs and non-VA settings. So we've, you know, in previous findings, about 67 to 77%. So we examined demographic characteristics of all SRTP estimated tobacco users. And for those of you not familiar with VA jargon, OEF, OIF, OND status refers to veterans from recent conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we found that a majority of SRTP patients were male between the ages of 30 and 55, identified as white, And a strong majority, as expected, had a mental health comorbidity, so about 90%. So let me explain this chart. So the line, the dotted red line, shows our estimated prevalence, so about 79% of patients. And the first bar shows the percent of SRTP patients that received tobacco dependence diagnosis at any time in fiscal year 10. The bar next to it on the right side shows the percent of SRTP patients that received any documented treatment for tobacco dependence in FY10. And the blue portion of the bar shows the percent of patients who received diagnosis or treatment while they were in SRTP care. And as you can see on the left-hand side, while 67% of SRTP patients were diagnosed sometime in fiscal year 10, only about 26% of them were diagnosed while they were in residential care. Similarly, while 50% of patients were treated for tobacco dependence sometime in FY10, only 27% were treated while they were in SRTP care. Now, it's important to note here that while the 26% diagnosed and 27% treated while in care looks similar, there's really only a 9% overlap between the two. So only about a third of those diagnosed were also treated, and vice versa. So this chart breaks down the types of treatments that patients in SRTP care received for tobacco dependence. And as we explored the VHA data, we quickly realized that we were very limited in terms of capturing the full scope of tobacco treatment. So the treatments that we were able to capture are listed here, and we had limitations that I'll discuss a little bit later. So of the 4,000 SRTP patients who received tobacco dependence treatment, about 94% received nicotine replacement therapy, and of those, a majority received it in patch form. Records of bupropion specified for tobacco use were rare at 1%, but we had limitations for capturing this data, and I'll explain this a little later. Varenicline was also uncommon at 2%. And because procedure codes or CPT codes don't exist for residential settings, we had no way of capturing psychosocial interventions for tobacco treatment within residential settings. However, because some patients can receive concurrent treatment, for example, if they get referred to a smoking cessation clinic while they're in residential care, we looked at CPT codes and program stop codes for patients and found that a small portion of patients did receive outpatient care while they were in residential treatment for tobacco dependence. So to identify factors associated with receipt of tobacco treatment, or specifically NRT, we used a multivariate mixed effects logistic regression model. And the model was run on all likely tobacco users. Receipt of NRT was chosen as the dependent variable because it was the most common treatment. Also, it's the most reliably tracked in the VHA data. The explanatory variables we used are listed here with the exception of OEF, OIF, OND status, and we excluded that here because it was not a significant predictor in the model. And to control for patient-level clustering within VHA medical centers, we included medical center as a random effect. And we found that NRT receipt was more likely among patients who received a tobacco dependence diagnosis in SRTP care during FY10. So patients who received a diagnosis within SRTP care were 25% more likely to get treatment within SRTP care, treatment being NRT. Other predictors of NRT included a history of tobacco dependence treatment in the previous year, being younger than 30, identifying as white, and having a mental health comorbidity. So as I mentioned, we did have some limitations for the quantitative component of our project. VHA data sets just don't capture tobacco counseling, so we were largely limited to pharmacotherapy treatments. And also, since bupropion can be provided for depression as Wellbutrin and tobacco dependence as Zyban, it was really difficult to estimate which was provided for bupropion that was provided for tobacco dependence. So we used a conservative estimate and only looked at bupropion where it was specified for smoking. However, obviously, providers can prescribe bupropion and just not indicate it for tobacco dependence in the pharmacy record. And lastly, our estimation of the prevalence of tobacco use could have been an underestimate, and unfortunately, we just didn't have access to status data, but we do now, and we will be comparing our results. So now to go over the qualitative component We interviewed 25 staff members from SRTV programs, ranging from psychiatrists to nurses, social workers, and we found that a majority had graduate level education. And because we knew from earlier studies that about 30 to 40% of addiction providers smoke, we asked individuals about their smoking status and found that about 40% reported being former smokers. However, curiously, nobody self-identified as a current smoker, but 16% said that they preferred not to say. Okay, so to assess provider knowledge, we asked participants to describe tobacco dependence interventions that they believed were evidence-based. And we found that although most people had sort of a general sense of pharmacotherapy and counseling, they had really limited knowledge about evidence-based treatments for tobacco dependence and really limited training specifically related to tobacco dependence. And in assessing attitudes and beliefs regarding tobacco dependence treatment specifically in SRTPs, we found that although interviewees agreed that tobacco use was harmful and that tobacco cessation was generally a good idea, they just didn't find that tobacco dependence treatment was a meaningful part of their duties in the SRTP program. So when asking about the current status of tobacco tobacco treatment service delivery, we found that few programs have fully integrated tobacco treatment with all the components that I described earlier. All programs reported screening and providing NRT, and while most programs said they offer counseling, they said that a lot of veterans just didn't access that service. So participants were asked about perceived barriers to integrating tobacco dependence, and we list the top 10 here. Some of these were things that we would expect, so not enough time, lack of training. Number four was challenges with enforcement would be a significant barrier, and suggested that both providers and patients who smoke would probably resist any sort of tobacco dependence integration into substance use settings and would also resist any restrictions on tobacco use. Staff also identified patients' lack of interest as a barrier. 76% reported this as a barrier, although from the literature we know that about 40 to 80% of individuals in addiction settings actually are interested in quitting. Other barriers were less expected. Staff bonding with patients by smoking together was listed by half of participants that we interviewed. So many of these barriers were identified with staff beliefs, were related to staff beliefs and myths, and this was consistent with findings in previous studies in non-VA settings. And finally, participants were asked about facilitators, and many suggested tobacco-free facilities or no tobacco tolerance policies. So patients in VA facilities are only permitted to smoke in specified areas. However, against regulation, we heard from staff that these specified areas are oftentimes near the residential setting or in highly visible, unavoidable spots. So this can be problematic for individuals that are trying to quit. And almost all staff indicated that they would like training. Staff were very excited about training, but they emphasized that there would need to be significant buy-in and support from leadership for it to be effective. And other suggestions were to track patient and program progress in delivering tobacco cessation treatments and to help programs partner with similar programs for support, networking, and problem solving. So to conclude, we found that tobacco treatment is underutilized in SRTPs. Only about a third of veterans with tobacco dependence are diagnosed or treated, and far more rarely both. There are patient, provider, and system-level barriers. And while these settings can provide a really unique opportunity to provide tobacco dependence treatment to this high, high-risk population, there really is likely going to have to be systematic efforts to change sort of the culture of these programs and address gaps in care. So just to share with you some of the next phase of our study, we used this data to develop a social marketing framework and a toolkit to help providers integrate tobacco treatment in subspecialty residential programs. And my colleague, Dr. Joy Austin Lane, will be presenting on this next phase tomorrow during a poster session. And if you're interested, please join her. Thank you.
Thank you to all presenters, and for all of those who are here, I'd also like to extend an invitation to you tomorrow evening from the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs section for its reception beginning at 6:30 right next door in the Golden Gate C2 room. And now is our time for questions of the presenters, and I am going to start off with a question that I have of the TRICARE Deloitte team to help warm everyone else up. And that is, you had a very large sample in your study. How do you accomplish that when you do a survey? Do you go through OMB? It is being recorded, so thank you.
We certainly have to go through OMB. We have to go through it, and it takes a while to get through the system. But we were really kind of surprised that, and you're talking about the survey, we're really surprised we had 5,000 people respond to it, because initially when Dr. Jeffrey talked about it, I said, I've been in active duty. No one's going to say that they've misused prescription drugs. It just won't happen. But she says, well, let's try it anyway. You know, I really want this to happen. So we did, and yeah, we had to go through all the regulations.
Okay. Thank you. And now I'll take questions from the floor. Yes. Is this Dr. Bray?
Yes.
And would you stand up, please, so we can all hear you?
OMB.
So what you're saying is the Office of Management and Budget has to clear the TRICARE survey.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I have a question about the web survey had a huge sample, but it seemed like a fairly low response rate, maybe 8-10% somewhere. So, you know, when you have low response rates, you always worry about bias. So how what do you do about that, and what do you think of the issues? Does that really impact the results?
So the overall question for everyone and for the recording is that the web survey had a low response rate of about 4%, and the questioner wonders whether there were some biases. And would you like to answer it, Doctor?
I think the thing that sure.
Thank you. As we play musical chairs.
Yeah. I think that what I can say is that we suspect that that this was because it is such a sensitive topic is what our best guess is, an understanding of the topic and why it is a low response rate. We did look at the demographic factors and kind of did some comparisons to the overall active duty. The active duty population, and I don't remember that we saw any huge differences, but I wasn't involved in a lot of that, so that's about all I can say.
Yes, please, I have another question in the back, and then I'll come up here. Yes. Please stand up so we can hear you. And the question is looking at stimulants. Okay, thank you.
So we actually do have all of that data, and what we found is that it was higher, particularly for those who had parents who served. What we are doing with this first set of papers, because only Washington State has sort of public school data around military service for adolescents, for kids in schools, we just wanted to get the information out around differences by military connection and deployment, and then we're doing another series of papers after the basic epidemiology where we start looking into that detail. But the rates overall in this population of prescription drug use were low, and so that's why they all got collapsed into that prescription drug use, yes or no.
I have a question for you, too.
I was just wondering, did you ever present those results back to the active duty members to show, you know, that there is an impact of them, of the parents going back-to-back deployment?
So we actually haven't. We have some people. Oh, the question was, have we actually presented the information back to the parents to show that there's this influence of potential influence of deployments? We haven't. What we're doing, we're working directly with the schools, and we work with the superintendents and principals, and we let them know what's going on in their schools. We just had a meeting with a superintendent at one of the districts, and they have one school that's actually on base. Some of these public schools actually have schools that are on base. And they had a 50% turnover rate for kids transitioning out because, you know, parents get reassigned or they get deployed. And they were talking about how that impacts their API, so that's their academic performance index, and how that, like, really tanked. And this was a high-performing school. So we're kind of working from that level of the system, but we fully expect the principals and the superintendent to then be communicating with the community. And we're trying to, you know, some other folks on the team are doing that too, but we haven't, not this, the data that I was presenting here today, they don't have it, so.
Thank you. Yes, please.
My question is also for Dr. I was wondering if you looked at the differences between a mother being deployed versus a father being deployed, and also if you look at single-parent households, whether there is any difference between a parent, but that was the only parent that was in your household.
So the question is whether there were differences in responses in families where the mother was deployed versus the father being deployed, or in single-parent households?
We actually don't have that data. We're developing, so because this is an ongoing collaboration with the California Department of Education, we're refining the questions. Like, we did this because we knew nothing, and now we know a whole lot more, but it raised a lot of questions around these details. The other thing that we're really missing that we get dinged on as we send our articles out is socioeconomic status, which would be related to single parent households. Again, because the California Healthy Kids Survey is ongoing, it's aggregate, and they try to remain confidential and anonymous, they've never asked that. So it's kind of a big deal, because that would be a question that would go on the core and not just military-related, to kind of get at those sorts of demographics that we think are important, too, but, you know, trying to balance the political parts of it, too.
Thank you. Other questions from the audience? Yes, please.
Question for Dr. Tavapoli? When you have people coming into residential treatment, is tobacco cessation offered, or is it only if they're seeking?
So the question is whether tobacco cessation is offered when someone comes into residential substance use treatment.
So there's really a lot of variability across regions. So we looked at programs just across the nation. And per VA policy, tobacco treatment should be available to all patients who need it in relevant specialty settings. So per policy, it should be available. And screening needs to happen just across the board, despite, you know, asking for it or not. And then, you know, per policy, brief intervention, counseling, pharmacotherapy should be provided. But it really varies. Some programs, everyone said they do screening, but in terms of providing treatment, that was really variable across facilities.
If they screen positive for
Yeah.
Say,
they're supposed to. Right, they're supposed to. But that doesn't always happen.
Yes.
So in the residential program, the things that people are being treated for are severe PTSD, homelessness, mental health issues that are really incapacitating. That's what the residential arena helps kind of address. And I also have a question of Sarah's group, and that is, given that
cigarettes are now taxed at the same rate as they are for the general public, because previously cigarettes sold, for example, at a commissary or a PX were not taxed, so their price was substantially lower than if you bought them at CVS. Have there been internal discussions in the VA about what they anticipate in terms of smoking rates? I know it would be informal because this only went into effect, as I believe, like a month ago, but I'm just curious if there's conversation about that topic.
Well, I don't know if there's been any.
Thank you.
I don't know if there's been any studies, but I know that some VAs, or most VAs, have a shop that provides tax-free products, and I think that's been eliminated in about like 70% of VAs, so I'm not sure how the increased tax in the general population is going to affect it, but that has been eliminated for the most part.
Yeah. Would you stand up, please, so we can... Right, and it's my belief that they still sell tobacco products at the commissaries, but they now tax those products. Huh. So, particularly in the younger population, they are sensitive to cost.
It is a federal excise tax.
Yes.
Across the board, I think that on the commissary, that those products.
No, they're also not taxed. Previously, until October 1st, they weren't taxed. So, okay. Any other questions?
I was going to ask a question of Dr. Jaffe.
Please go to the point.
Well, I'll let her answer. But I was just curious about when you were looking at the veterans under 50 and over 50, if there were any differences within those age groups. So those who were, say, 40 versus 50 or 30 versus 50, if you saw any differences.
And if you repeat the
cohorts. So the question was, in the general population study, if there were differences in the veteran sample within the two larger age strata, above and below 50, for smaller gradations of age. And the question is longer than the answer, which is, I'm not sure, because I didn't look at the data that way.
So I'm just wondering about the different cohorts that went through different.
Right. So there are different cohorts that you might be able to map a little bit to specific conflict periods or peacetime service, something like that. But I haven't looked at the data that way.
Any other questions? Well, I want to thank our presenters very much. We hope to see you tomorrow evening, and thank you.